Have you ever wondered who it is that comes up with all those great ideas for television and print commercials? All those fun things that we like to see, and we even watch the Super Bowl to see, that kind of thing. This morning we have one of those people with us. His name is Ron Anderson. He's an ad man. He attends Ridgewood Church in Minnetonka, and he's going to share with us. He's the one that came up with Got Milk. Come and share with us this morning.
Summer Sunday in Wichita, Kansas. I was 18 years old. I was going to a small church, Landmark Baptist. The people at Landmark would probably have called me unchurched. In my mind, I'd been sprinkled as a baby, confirmed at 12, and hadn't been to church since. But I thought I was okay. I was there for the youth fellowship. On that day, we were going swimming at Horseshoe Lake. Not being a very good swimmer, I planned to just kind of splash around in the shallow area. I didn't know it was a sand pit. The next thing I know, I'm in 18 foot of water, in full panic. Then nothing. 10 minutes later, I woke up with my face in the sand. I couldn't see, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't speak, but I could hear. As they were giving me CPR, I heard, "Is he dead? Is he dead?" Then I heard sirens in the distance. My sister was washing her car when she heard on the radio that there had been a drowning accident at Horseshoe Lake. Roland Anderson of 222 West Ailey had died. That night, as I lay recovering in the hospital, my pastor was there for me. I identified at the age of 18 with mortality. I recognized the tenuous thread of life that we all cling to. I committed my life that night to Jesus Christ. But that wasn't the end of my struggles. Do I serve Jesus Christ or do I serve man? Or can I serve both? I got a job in an ad agency while attending Wichita State, and after graduation, I married my beautiful wife, Char, of 43 years now, and we moved to Minneapolis. That's the other Char Anderson. I was a driven young man, driven to overcome a life of poverty in an alcoholic home. At the same time, driven to fulfill my commitment to God. I always had my eye on the next move up in the agency. Art director, then creative director. I bought the agency, on to president, vice chairman, and chairman. And I had some professional accomplishments along the way, creating Hamburger Helper, the other white meat for pork, and the milk mustache campaign. But was I putting God on the back burner? I tried to balance it with ad campaigns for charities, churches, the Episcopal Ad Project, ad campaigns for the Southern Baptist Convention, the Presbyterians, even two ad campaigns for Wooddale, including Wooddale Church, a place to belong, a place to become. In 1987, we were transferred to New York City, and we prayed that God would use us, and he did. I was involved in advertising for the Billy Graham and Central Park Crusade with edgy lines like a subway poster that said, "You're born, you suffer, you die. Fortunately, there's a loophole. That loophole is Jesus Christ." Campaigns for the National Bible Association with billboards like, "If God wrote an editorial in the newspaper, you'd read it, wouldn't you?" To promote Bible reading. In 1995, we returned to Minnesota. I was asked to present for the Billy Graham Evangelism Association. We would make a 60-minute presentation to their leadership team. Now, this was an answer to my dreams. First, it was a big account, but secondly, it was really doing what I felt good about. And I wanted them to know where my priorities were. So like any good ad man, I wanted to make a good close. And so I closed with my obituary. I was looking at these guys, Cliff Barrows and older guys, and I said to them, "Do you ever think about, you know, looking backward rather than forward, thinking about how am I going to be remembered?" I said, "Now, Cliff, your obituary is already locked and loaded. Every major newspaper in America's got it. But what about a humble ad man like me? How am I going to be remembered?" So I wrote my own. And I got nice big space, you know, like only an ad man can get. Big picture. It says, "Ron Anderson, famous ad man, dies at 92. I want to give myself a good run." And of natural causes, I didn't want anything strange. Born January 4th, 1936, beloved husband of Charlotte, devoted father of Nicole, Rex, and Matthew, Ron created classic campaigns for brands like Hamburger Helper, Chrysler, the other white meat for pork, something special in the air for American Airlines, Got Milk. But the campaign he was most proud of is the highly successful campaign for the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association that made the transition from Billy Graham, the icon, to the global ministry of Franklin Graham. "We will miss Ron terribly," said Billy Graham, age 112. We got the account. And I have now achieved the spiritual balance that I've sought throughout my life. I am now more interested in Got God than Got Milk.
There are some people who have hard lives. They are surrounded by bad people and bad circumstances. They work for dysfunctional companies. They have strange neighbors, weird relatives. The government is corrupt. The courts are unjust. And you want to grab them by the face and say, "Do you ever think that the problem might be you? I mean, this may be you and not everybody else." We have a victim mentality that says everything is somebody else's fault. Somebody else is to blame. When Peter wrote to the first century Christians, it is true that they were surrounded by enormous persecution and difficulty. And most of the 20 principles that he writes in the New Testament are for how to live successfully when surrounded by tough times caused by others. But he pauses long enough to offer a principle that is for those of us who need to take a look inside. We need to be honest enough to admit that we can't do a whole lot to change other people or to change circumstances, but we can do something about ourselves. He writes, "Therefore, rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation, now that you have tasted that the Lord is good." So Peter sounds something like a first century spiritual environmentalist when he tells us to get rid of the toxins in our souls. He talks as if there is a toxic waste dump with the chemicals of sin and self-destruction. The picture that he points to is one where we have allowed these toxins to build up inside of us until we're radioactive. Until we are ill-equipped to either love God or love other people. And his advice is to get rid of all this. Actually, the New Testament Greek term that Peter uses is a term to strip off your clothes. It's almost like someone who is working in a chemical factory and there's a spill. And that person rushes to the shower and pulls the emergency lever. And in the process is stripping off clothes to get rid of the chemicals that have such destructive potential. He says, "Rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind." So he gives us a list. Toxin number one is malice. Actually, it's a generic title. It refers to all of the toxins, and he becomes a little bit more specific later on. Malice, of course, is a word that's related to our word for malignant. And it is a word that we like neither to speak nor to hear, knowing that there are many different types of cancers, but none of them are good. And you want to get rid of all of them. And so it's almost as if Peter is telling us that we should do a CT scan of the soul, that we should check out inside of us and find out if there is any wickedness that is in us. It may range from self-centeredness to murder, from a bad attitude to a bad action. Is there anything sinful in our lives that should be confessed to God and forgiven and then dumped? But perhaps fearing that the generic reference to malice is not enough, he becomes more specific. So Peter talks about toxin number two, which is deceit. That is leading people in a way that actually misleads them for our own selfish purposes. It's something that we're all prone to do on a regular basis. Sometimes it is telling a technical truth that actually deceives the other person into a decision to behave in a way that we choose for them to behave, but if they had full disclosure, they would never make that same decision. It's when you have a car for sale and you know that there is a leak in the engine, oil or antifreeze. And before your first customer comes after a phone call in response to a classified ad, you rush off to the car wash and you clean the engine. And it gives the impression that you keep your car perfectly, perfectly clean, when the truth of it is you are disguising a leak. Or this is the woman who submits a resume to a potential employer that is exaggerated. She lists all of these responsibilities that she has had in other companies. The truth of it is that she once upon a time did one of those things for 15 minutes 12 years ago when somebody else didn't show up, and she didn't really do it very well. But she lists it on her resume as if that is something that she's very good at. Deceit is representing myself as better than I am. It is withholding full information. Deceit is, at its very core, trickery. It's tricking someone into doing what I want them to do. And it is a toxin of the soul. Toxin number three is hypocrisy. You know that the New Testament was first written in Greek, and for the most part, all of it has been translated into English. However, the translators, on some very rare occasions, just didn't translate the word. They left it in Greek. And this is one of those occasions. So the word that Peter wrote was actually the word hypocrisy. It was, in his society, a reference to actors on a theater stage. This is someone who plays a part, who speaks lines, who pretends to be someone that he is not. Now, on a theater stage, that's fine because everybody understands it, but it is quite a different matter when that is the way we live life. Playing a part, speaking lines that are not the lines that correctly represent us. It is being inauthentic. It is typically rooted in a fear that if we ever showed who we really are, people wouldn't like us or respect us. And so we live much, if not all, of life as if we are actors on a stage, playing a part that is not our own. Toxin number four is envy, and it is probably one of the most common pollutants of the soul. Envy is rooted in comparison. It is comparing ourselves to other people. Envy is, in one, I think, insightful explanation, feeling really good about bad things that happen to other people, or feeling really awful about good things that happen to other people. So here is someone who gets a promotion, gets a check in the mail that's unexpected, is recognized by others, liked by other people, enters a relationship that's terrific, and gets a brand new car, and I find out about all of this, and it just ruins my day. I mean, I hate it when good things happen to other people. But by contrast, when the other person gets fired, gets an unexpected bill, a broken relationship, is put down by other people, ooh, that feels so good. I mean, it just feels good to have bad things happen to other people. And all of this is, in fact, the opposite of love. Christian love is when I am saddened by bad things that happen to other people, and I am gladdened by good things that happen to other people. Number five on Peter's toxin list is the last, and that is slander. Slander is saying bad things about other people, and it is usually done when the other person isn't there. Slander is sort of a feel-good sin. Or so I've heard, you know, from other people that, I mean, it's not my own personal experience. It feels good. It feels good to gossip about other people and to put somebody else down. It may be a technical truth. It doesn't matter whether it's truthful or not. What slander is a shot that is fired in the war of ratings. And that we think that by speaking ill of someone else, that will lower them in this war of ratings, and somehow that will raise me in the war of ratings. But you know, there's a strange irony to slander. For while it is supposed to lower the other person, typically, if I slander someone else, it really lowers me. And that's why Peter lists it as a toxin of the soul. Now, to be sure, this is not an exhaustive list. This is simply a sampling. If the whole catalog were read, there would be hundreds and hundreds of other toxins named, and they come in thousands of different flavors. I do, however, find it interesting that when Peter gives his list, he includes no theological heresies or sexual sins or social injustices. Not that those matters are not elsewhere addressed in the Bible, and not that those are not matters of concern and evil. But this particular list is about sins of the soul that are detriments to our loving God and loving one another. And the point here is not so much either that this is an exhaustive list or that the list much matters. The point here is that we get rid of these things. Whatever are the toxins in our souls of which we are guilty, that we dump them, that we confess them, that we change our attitudes and our behaviors. You know, it's kind of like getting up in the morning and you look in the mirror and you check yourself out and you think, nobody's going to see me like this. Nobody. So you get in the shower and you get washed and you get cleaned up and you get dressed up. Peter's saying that we ought to look into our own souls and say, neither God nor anyone else should ever see me like this. What I need to do is wash up and clean up. I need to confess my sins and have them forgiven and change my behavior and get rid of the spiritual toxins. Now, before we leave Peter's point, maybe a personal quick inventory would be helpful. What are the evils, the sins, the wickednesses, the toxins in your own soul that you need to get rid of? Rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. Now, getting rid of toxins is fine, but it's not good enough, because at best that brings us to zero. So Peter goes on to tell how to grow spiritually strong and healthy. He writes, like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation, now that you have tasted that the Lord is good. So the picture here is of a brand new baby. And brand new babies in every country and culture and race and chapter of history, the first thing they do is get milk. I mean, it's a universal phenomenon. They are born, many babies, with their mouths open, and it becomes the beginning of a lifelong quest to get nourishment. We give babies milk because, among other things, it is an amazing food. There are some who say it is the most nearly perfect food because it's loaded with nutrients. It has carbohydrates and fats and minerals and proteins and vitamins. So it has many of the ingredients that are most helpful for energy and for growth. And interestingly, all milk of all mammals in the animal kingdom is surprisingly similar. Yeah, there are some variations in percentages and things like that, but there is a stunning similarity. And in every case, the purity of the milk is critical. In our 21st century culture in America, we go to great lengths with refrigeration to keep the milk from becoming contaminated, with pasteurization, where milk is heated to kill off the bacteria. It is not only to be kept pure, but it also comes in a broad variety of forms. So you may start out with whole milk, but it can be turned into butter or cheese or sour cream or ice cream or yogurt, all kinds of variations. So when you hear the advertisers say, got milk, it doesn't necessarily require a white upper lip. It may include even a candy bar. It's not just a glass of milk, but maybe an ice cream cone or a slice of cheese. Now, of course, when St. Peter asks if we got milk, he's not talking about the white liquid from the cow. He's talking about pure spiritual milk. The Greek word that he uses for spiritual primarily refers to the truth of God in the Word of God, the Bible. However, it can also be rendered to be broader than that. It is whatever means is available for us to grow spiritually. So it certainly includes the Bible. But it may include prayer, especially during prayer when we are quiet long enough to listen to God. Or it may be teaching, or it may be what we receive from reading a book or listening to the radio or watching television. One of the means of spiritual growth is fasting. The idea, or one of the ideas of Lent, is that we give up something during this 40 days prior to Easter, and that creates space in our lives and in our souls to be filled up with something that God can thereby insert. So all these different meanings, all these different means, so that we can grow spiritually. But he makes a point, Peter does, that this spiritual nourishment also must be pure. And thereby he implies the potential of contamination of the spiritual resources available to us. Something that I see often. That even the spiritual milk may be contaminated by greed or by heresy or by politics or by stupidity. You know, in our country and culture, we are very careful about our health. If you hear that a restaurant has failed,